College basketball tournaments are back, and so are brackets. Get comfy on your couch, turn off that Zoom camera, and sign up for your men's and women's USA Today sports bracket. Register at brackets.usatoday.com.
The Counter, an NFL podcast from USA Today Sports.
Welcome to The Counter. Chris Corman here, joined as always by Steven Ruiz and Charles McDonald. What's up, fellas?
I'm bored.
Bored? What are you bored for? Come on, man.
Free agency, the franchise tag. It's just been boring. Who's excited about any of this?
It's warm. It's warm. You can go on a walk. You can walk around D.C.
Are you excited to see where Anthony Harris lands?
Yeah, he was the 41st ranked free agent on our board, which I think is a major divergence from everyone else.
I still have an open challenge to anyone to explain why Anthony Harris is good without citing his PFF grade. It's an impossible task.
Or saying Harrison Smith.
that's true.
We are going to get into a little bit of the free agency talk. It is, what are we recording? It's Wednesday, so it's the day after the franchise tag the final date. A bunch of the best players got tagged. Dak Prescott obviously signed a new deal with the Cowboys. We're all very excited to see that he won out over Jerry Jones. Steven writing one of the better leads in For the Win history, which was just a bunch of laughs when we saw that news. So we're gonna Chuck has put together a board of 50 top free agents. It is a little anticlimactic, but we'll go through that. Steven has paired up one player per team, which was a really tricky exercise this year because the cap has actually gone down. It's going to be 180,000, somewhere around there. 1825. Am I remembering correctly? And that's down from 198,000 last year. And obviously, teams plan. They build all their contracts as if it's going to keep going up. So, what'd you say, Stephen? 10 teams are projected already to be over the cap. Some of them are wildly over the cap. Chuck wrote about that. He tried to trace a path for the Rams, Eagles, and Saints in a post today to get back into compliance. It's going to be difficult for all three of those teams. But we will look at that. We'll look at these. Steven, try to pair up, you know, potential possible pairings. His pick for the New Orleans Saints was anyone who will play for free. And that's really where the Saints are.
Loving it.
Yeah. So college students get those internship applications in. Saints need a defensive lineman.
That's actually every college player. So, you know, they just need to pretend that they're getting the player degree and they'll pay them that way. Like just take some general studies classes or something. So we're gonna talk about that. And then we have Bryce Rossler from Sports Info Solution coming on the show. He's gonna talk about their draft guide that they put out each year, which is just a fantastic resource. It's one of the better things out there if you are trying to do the impossible and understand what the players out there and where they should get drafted and what goes into all of those decisions being made by NFL teams. Those teams spend millions upon millions upon millions of dollars scouting these players and compiling this information. And you can get it all in a tidy book for like $30. So it's pretty helpful to have. And Bryce is going to dig in on some of the findings that they came up with and some of the interesting things that turned up when they put the stats together. Obviously, the college year was unlike anything we've ever seen before. So it was a different process and that led to some innovation. So he's going to dig in on all of that a little bit later in our interview. But let's get to the free agency situation. So it starts Monday is the quiet. I don't know what to call it. The negotiation period, I guess. There's 2 days where agents and teams can negotiate. And then the new league year starts on March 17th. And that's when deals can actually be signed. So we're on the precipice of it, but it sure does feel pretty anticlimactic. largely because of the franchise tag, this weird NFL only thing where teams can essentially bar their best play. It's always the good players can stop them from hitting free agency.
It's not always the good players. Like, well, Kane Robinson got franchise tagged. Yeah, and that's like the point where we should be like, what are we doing here? What is the franchise tag? Cam Robinson?
Yeah, Cam Robinson wasn't even on my top 50 list for free agents. That one felt kind of unnecessary, but just in general, like, we just lose so much of the discussion before it even starts. Like, Allen Robinson, franchise tag. Oh, God bless him. Because if you saw what he was like on Twitter yesterday when he got the tag, he was not happy. He basically, like in any tweet that said the franchise tag should be abolished. Allen Robinson, doomed to another season with the Bears. Right. Chris Godwin going back to Tampa Bay. Justin Simmons going back to Denver. Brandon Scherff got tagged. Tyler Moten got tagged. Len Williams got tagged. Marcus Williams got tagged. I mean, these are all the top 25
of all top 25 of your list.
It's fun when these guys get to change teams and you just get, you know, a little something else to add fuel to the fire of hope of the offseason. But it just seems like we're just getting these guys just tagged and we know we're back where they're going. And it's just not fun for us as consumers. And I just hate that that's a thing that teams can do to those guys too.
Right.
I think people talk about how to make the NFL offseason more fun and they just overthink it. The reason why the NBA offseason is more fun, it's not because there's a legal tampering period or whatever the NBA has, and the NFL, like, I think that's a new thing the last couple of years. The reason why the NBA offseason is fun is because the players have power. They can do things. Like, they can choose their own destiny. NFL players don't, so it's boring. That's the difference between the two leagues.
Right. And NFL players are starting to get some power. Like, Deshaun Watson is in a lot of ways, Deshaun Watson exercising his power probably gave leverage to Dak Prescott because, it just made it apparent that if a star quarterback really wants to force his way, there's not much a team can do. It's just like the Texans are playing hardball as much as they can, and they just look awful. They look like they have no plan. But we're not there yet. I mean, and the NFL exploits the fact that the players union in football is gigantic, and it's mostly populated by people who are not going to be there very long and not make that much money. So they vote for their own self-interest,
right?
And they tuck this rule in and say, well, we're going to punish these guys at the top of the scale, but we'll give you a little bit more along the way. You know, we'll make the base salaries a little bit higher, and it really ruins the off season. Go ahead.
I'm about to say, it would just be so fun if we were in a world where, like, Dak Prescott was actually ever going to hit the market. You know,
right?
Like, I would just love to see, you know, teams just throwing money all over each other to try to get Dak Prescott and see how much money that he could get. But we kind of get this watered down version of where, yeah, you know, $40 million a year is obviously significant and makes him one of the highest paid quarterbacks in the game. But imagine if Dallas had to, like, bid against another team and just to see how astronomical those numbers could get. So, you know, franchise tag, let's get rid of it. Cap space, let's get rid of it. And I think that would be a lot of fun for people.
Right, right. So we're left with this is off Charles's big board. As I said, it's on our site. FTW.usatoday.com, ranking the top 50 NFL free agents of the 2021 season. Sure, he's tweeted it from @Forverts too, but if you want to find this list, we'll keep it updated. The Dak Prescott was number one. Number two is still out there, Trent Williams, the tackle for the 49ers. And, like, Trent Williams, a great player, a great story, but, like, he's a tackle. You know what I mean? Like, he's a very good offensive tackle, but it's just not. And, you know, the 49ers should just keep him, too. You know, like, there's just not that much going on here. Then Will Fuller is next on our list, right? Who's, like, a fairly premier one-dimensional wide receiver, but, like, just a guy who does one thing. Like, this is not a great conversation we're having. Kenny Golladay, I think, was next on the list. Like, again, a guy who's probably has room to grow and get better and, you know, has been.
He played for the Lions.
Right, right. He's been in that he's had the Lions stink on him for a little bit, but not a great one. Charles, from this list, who are you like sort of intrigued by as you were, you know, you were putting this list together, and obviously you, these are your thoughts as to the value, the relative value of each guy, but just somebody that you're intrigued by on this list that, you know, as you were compiling it sort of popped down like, oh, you know what? This is a guy who I think is going to be a good value.
Well, I guess not. This is not really good value, but the one that popped out to me was Aaron Jones from the Packers, just because I'm just really interested to see what happens there with his free agency decision. I mean, he's been linked to the Dolphins a lot, and that the Dolphins a lot, and that makes sense because I mean they desperately need a running back. I mean, I think if you ask like your average NFL fan who started running back for the Dolphins last year, like, have no idea, and I only like barely know. And it's one of the guys' last thing was like Ahmed or something. So you know, it makes sense for him to go there, but you know, it's just gonna spark up that debate, like, oh, how much do you pay running back? Like, how much do running backs get paid? How much is it right to pay running back? Do running backs deserve healthcare, shelter, water? You know? And you know, I'm just interested to see, you know, thinking about what we know about running backs in 2021 NFL, and you know, I guess the Dolphins being somewhat of a forward thinking organization, just how they attack that offseason, and it'd just be interesting to see what the final numbers on that deal would be, because he's going to ask for, you know, elite running back money, as he should, based on how he's played over the past few years and the numbers that he's put up. Like, that's something he should definitely be asking for, but it's just going to be interesting to see what the final numbers turn out to be based on what we know about running backs and how they should be valued and kind of how teams have shifted away from that, I guess, a little bit over the past few years, unless you're like a Christian McCaffrey or Derek Henry, where you are like 100% the offense.
And it's kind of rare to see a running back at this point in his career get to free agency. Like, we talk about how running backs have been devalued, but all the big running backs have gotten contracts. They haven't had a problem getting paid. Like, Melvin Gordon is the one who didn't get a contract, and I don't think he was really an elite back, whereas Aaron Jones at least has produced like one. So it will be interesting to see where running back value is when a guy gets to the open market. And he's a guy that's still in his prime, still productive. He's coming from a system that a lot of teams around the league are running now. I would think a team like the Jets might be interested in him. But I want to see how much a running back gets paid on the open market, because we haven't seen it in – I don't even know the last time we saw a back this good go to the open market.
Yeah. Steven, you went about the work of trying to give each team one free agent, and we're not going to go through all 32, but I wanted to highlight three of the more interesting ones. Again, this is the headline on this one. You can find it on our site ranking – or no, I'm sorry. That's the wrong – I've already read that one. What was the headline? Picking one player each of the 32 NFL teams should sign in free agency. You and this was also built a little bit on the work that you did early in the week, where you produced scouting reports for the wide receivers. Of course, two of them that you looked at closely were then franchise tagged almost immediately. But you from that work, you came away with the feeling that Corey Davis, the Titans wide receiver, might be a hidden value. You saw something there that, you know, he's not, I think the average fan probably does not lump him in with Robinson, Godwin. And we're not saying he's that good, but he sort of has the ability to outplay the contract he's going to get, which most free agents, quite frankly, don't do. And you paired him with the Ravens. What did you like about that pairing there?
I think he fits in well with that offense. He's a tough wide receiver. I think that's the thing that stands out is, one, he's huge. How big he is, how tough he is. The Titans used him a lot as a blocker. Like, you could use him as an extra tight end if you want. I mean, not like lined up as a tight end, but, you know, line him up in condensed formations and have him block. And he's a willing blocker. And I think he gives Lamar Jackson a receiver he's never had. And that's a reliable guy that can go over the middle and make a contested catch. Like, you would like Mark Andrews to be that guy, but yeah, it seems like in big games he drops every pass that's thrown to him.
The ball has to be thrown into Mark Andrews for it to stick. Like, he's just is not. Whereas Davis, you know, I think you wrote that just like anything near him, he absorbs.
And I think he's a guy that has speed, and he could be a deep threat if that's how you want to use him. He's really good on play action. That's obviously a thing the Titans used a lot with Ryan Tannehill. He's good at those deep over routes. And I think just adding him to that offense could help them return to what they were in 2019 when they were able to use a lot of play action because they had all these tight ends. Obviously, Davis isn't a tight end, but like I said, you could use him in that role if you wanted to. Kind of like how the Rams use their slot receivers. So that's one I want to see just because I want Lamar to have that type of target. I think the Ravens were hoping Dez Bryant could be that when they signed him last year. He could be that contested catch guy. I think Davis isn't 50 years old. He's not Dez Bryant. He's in his prime. So I think he could be that guy.
Yeah, I like that fit a lot too. And just get Lamar some receivers, man. That's just
get him some.
We talked about it recently, but that's just got to be the goal for them, because that offense can just take off with him and just a couple guys that are legit on the outside would just take the offense to the next level.
And Corey Davis can line up on the outside too. I don't want to like paint him as like some power slot guy. He's not that, but that's just Tennessee used a lot of condensed formations. So, and he proved he can do it. So, you know, put him in that Baltimore offense. I really think he could be like an 80 catch, 1,200 yards, 10 touchdown guy in that offense. I don't think he's like that good in a vacuum, but with that offense, he can be that guy.
Right. And yeah, it opens up a lot of stuff for Hollywood Brown too, who we were talking about recently. He's not a guy who's going to do it on his own, but if you have Davis running a bunch of routes over the middle, then, you know, maybe that allows Hollywood to go over the top and get some of those deeper passes. So your next pairing was, this is a sentimental one for you, I think, Cam Newton going to the Washington football team. You're getting Cam and Ron back together, buddy.
It's sentimental, but it's like just makes so much sense as I lay out in the post. You have a team that needs a quarterback. I don't think they're going to be looking to spend too much on a quarterback, and they can't really draft one who's going to play right away where they're drafting this year. Obviously, Cam knows Ron Rivera. He's been in Scott Turner's system. He had arguably the best half a season he's ever had under Scott, under that offense. It was Norv running the offense at the time. And I would just like to see Cam in a place where he could play behind a good offensive line. He has a receiver in McLaren. They have a good defense. I think you add a competent quarterback to that. And I know a lot of people were happy with what Alex Smith did last year, but let's face it, he was a bad quarterback. He was barely better than Dwayne Haskins, and everyone just wanted to run Dwayne Haskins out of town. I think you bring in Cam, and Washington is the favorite in that division again.
By the way, is there so much nepotism among coaches that we can just get rid of first names and just start calling people by their last names? Just like Turner, Belichick. Kubiak. Yeah, I mean, let's just start using last. We'll just be like the family of. Like it's all just being passed down like a monarchy. Yeah, I mean, the Redskins could be sneaky good next year, right? Is that your read of this, Charles?
The what?
Defense. Washington football team.
Yeah, I mean, I think they can be good. Because, like, you're bringing back the defensive line. You're going to get year two of Chase Young, which I'm sure is just going to be scary hours.
Yeah.
How good he was as a rookie. You just have those guys another year in the system. I still think that when it comes to Washington's defense, I think the talent is carrying, you know, the scheme a little bit. Mm-hmm. But hey, like all those guys are coming back. Like another year of Montez Sweat, another year of John Allen, another year of Chase Young. You're going to have Jeremy Reeves and Cam Curl back in safety. Like this is a pretty, you know, just personnel wise, a pretty strong defense. So I would expect them to get back, and I really hope that defensive line takes another step because, you know, we're entering like some crazy territory with the amount of talent they already have. And if those guys can get better, that defense is going to be a little overwhelming.
Yeah.
And if you're able to use that first round pick on a not quarterback and add maybe another weapon to that offense, I think, and we saw Antonio Gibson was really good in certain spots last year.
Yeah.
McCorn, I think, is going to take another step, especially if he has a better quarterback who can throw deep. I think Washington could be a team that could win 10, 11 games if they play all their cards right, which it's Washington. They just used on a guard for the second straight year when guards are paid like offensive tackles by the franchise tag. They're paying Brandon Scherff it's $18 million a year. The second highest paid guard on a per year average is Brandon Brooks at $14 million.
Like, why did they not just sign him to a deal? I don't get it.
He is injury prone, which maybe that's why. But now, if you're Brandon Scherff, why are you even? I would sign that franchise tender right away and take that $18 million.
Yeah.
And then you know they're not going to tag you a third time, so you're going to be a free agent. That's when the cap is going to explode because there's going to be a new TV deal. Like, Brandon Scherff is sitting pretty right now. He's probably the only one that's happy that he got franchise tag.
Your third pairing is you're giving Bill Belichick a tight end again. He's felt like a little exposed without having a good tight end for the last 2 years. It's just been rough for him. So you're giving him Hunter Henry, who Belichick himself has admitted he's followed for a long time.
Yeah, I'm kind of uncomfortable with how closely Belichick has said he's followed. Like, apparently he's been watching him since he was in high school.
Yeah.
Which is a little disturbing.
I agree. I agree with that.
But that offense, as bad as the receiving core was, the tight ends were even worse. Like, name a tight end on them. On the Patriots.
A Devin Asisi guy or whatever?
The only reason you know that is because his name.
Yeah, I know. I can never pronounce it correctly.
Yeah, and he was hurt for most of the year. So Belichick is a guy that loves tight ends. Like, if you hear him talk about tight ends, he really loves that position, and he understands the value of having one that can block and catch passes. And Hunter Henry is a free agent, and they have cap space. I think he could pretty much sign right now. Like, that's where he's ending up.
I like it. I love when you predict.
Just big
prediction. How it's going to go. Yeah.
and it's going to be wrong now. He's going to sign with the Saints somehow.
The Saints will he'll decide to play for free just to be.
The Saints are going to sign all these guys.
If he goes to the Saints, he might end up playing quarterback. So, he'll get moved there. All right, let's turn to our buddy Bryce now, and let's have some draft season. Let's look ahead to the draft. All right, now we're going to bring on Bryce Rossler, our pal from Sports Info Solutions. He works in research and development there for that wonderful site, which we use all the time. We are constantly referencing it in our posts. If you haven't checked it out, you should. Bryce, what's going on?
Not a whole lot, Chris. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good, man. Pretty good. Thank you for joining us. I know that you wanted to talk about one of the products that SIS does, has been doing for a few years now, and is just an incredible resource, one of our favorites when it comes time to do the impossible and try to make sense of the NFL draft. And that's the SIS Football Rookie Handbook. That's available on their site. You guys should definitely read that. Tell us, Bryce, a little bit about this year's additions. What has changed? What you've added? Some of the new innovations? What sets it apart a little bit from what you guys have done in recent years?
So this was obviously a strange year because of the pandemic. One of the big changes that we made was to scale all of our stats on a rate basis rather than a total basis, just because there were such disparities in the number of games played by the different conferences. So that was a big change for us. And another thing that we added that we are really excited about is a new version of our proprietary metric total points, which is total points rating. And what that does is it essentially takes a number that is otherwise not very intuitive and puts it on a scale that is more readily conceptualized and consumed.
So when you got the results, or when you just looked at the total point rating for the top prospects, were there any players that stood out, whether it was you didn't expect them to do so well in the rating or they didn't do as well as you would expect? And I like the quarterbacks is who everyone wants to know about. So if there's any quarterbacks, that's what I would like to hear about.
Always the quarterbacks.
So total points rating is not that different from total points per snap, because that's the basis for it. So like with total points per snap, you're always going to look at it and you will be surprised by how high or low a guy ranked. One of the things that surprised me was how low Trevor Lawrence ranked. I mean, he was not terrible by any means, but I think I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but he was somewhere towards the end of the top 20 among all college quarterbacks last year, whereas Zach Wilson was top 5. So that's always an interesting thing to me, is to reconcile talent with performance, because they're not always the same thing. And we are not trying to tell anybody that Zach Wilson is better than Trevor Lawrence. That's not what we're saying. We are just trying to describe.
Well, why not?
What happened? Do you really want to get into that?
Yeah. Yeah, we do.
So I think, first of all, and this is me speaking, I am not the official spokesperson for SIS. So this is me personally.
Yeah, we get that. It's okay.
But I just had to couch that. Trevor Lawrence has 3 years of production. He has ranked extremely well by basically all of our metrics for 3 years running, whether that's total points, whether that's on target stuff like P-comp plus minus, if you're familiar with that, or completion percentage over expectation. We also recently introduced on target plus or minus, which is something that we're hoping to roll out in more of our products moving forward, which is basically the same idea as completion percentage over expectation, just with accuracy metrics rather than completions. So you look at his body of work over 3 years, he's ranked really well in the passing stuff. He's also ranked really well in the running stuff. He's done it against Power 5 competition for 3 years running. He has the recruiting pedigree, which I think personally is important. I think that says a lot about a guy coming into school to be recruited that highly and ranked that highly. And I put weight into that, just as a sort of baseline of physical talent to some extent. And then you look at Zach Wilson, really only 1 year of high production, did it at BYU, which is an independent. The schedule wasn't particularly strong. I don't think he's as physically talented as Lawrence is. And that would be my reasoning for Lawrence over Wilson, is just you can be very confident that Lawrence is what we think he is. And Zach Wilson, I'm not nearly as confident that he is what people think he is.
So total points is kind of a vague term. Can you kind of explain what goes into it and what it's based on?
So total points is our expected points division of credit. So obviously a single player is not responsible for everything that happens on a play. And what we do is we use the data points we collect from charting to try and divvy up the credit more appropriately. Because, you know, for example, a running back rushes for 2,000 yards. Well, that wasn't all his doing. The offensive line was a big part of that. So we should split the credit accordingly. And that's what total points attempts to do. But because we're talking about decimals, it's not as intuitive as yards. Like, you know conceptually what 5 yards is. But what is 0.04 EPA? I don't know what 0.04 EPA is. So you look at total points rating and the numbers are more distinguishable from one another, because we've all played Madden. We've all been to school and we know what the difference between a 99 is and an 80 is. and what total points rating is. It's just distinguishing players from one another on their own little bell curve and communicating that total points per snap statistic in a different and more intuitive way.
So in the book, you guys kind of, I think you guys go through position by position, or at least facets of the game, like passing game, run game, and what goes into it. But just generally speaking, like, I would imagine a wide receiver drops a pass, a quarterback is not going to get docked for that. But is there anything more specific that goes into it? Like, is a play call going into it? A play action pass, does maybe a quarterback get a little bit less credit? Or just generally speaking along those lines, this, how much does scheme or play call matter?
So there is an acknowledgement of play selection because the coach obviously owns some of that. So take, for example, a draw call on a 2nd and 20. Unless the running back breaks it for a huge gain, he's going to have a terrible EPA on the play. But is it his fault that his coach is a coward and called a really inefficient play on 2nd and long? No. So we set some expectation for the outcome of a play given the circumstance. Now, one of the things that we're excited about working on this offseason is incorporating even more information about the play selection beyond runner pass to account for the things that you mentioned, like play action, that will tell us a little bit more about the player's skill than the coach doing things more efficiently than maybe some other coaches do.
So, for example, like a player like Zach Wilson, who you said he performed well in it, but he had cleaner pockets, he had more open receivers. So he had to not overcome, but he had to go even beyond that to perform well in total points. It wasn't just, hey, he was in an ideal situation and that's why he put up this number. It actually separates it. Whereas EPA, like a guy like Kirk Cousins performs well in EPA every year, even though, I mean, you watch him, Kirk Cousins has been better, but he's not the most impressive quarterback. Is that the big difference between EPA and total points, which is based on EPA?
Yeah, and there are things that, as I alluded to, that we're working on to improve this because we aren't content to rest on our laurels. And one of the things we want to do is determine how a passer functioned relative to the play call on a more granular level to better distinguish, you know, the Kirk Cousinses of the world from the Deshaun Watsons. And that's something we're really excited about moving forward.
So I believe you wrote the reports for Travis Etienne. And like any discussion about running backs, it's going to come down to value and where they should be drafted. And he's one of the bigger name running backs in this class. Where would you draft him personally? You've obviously watched him. You've written about him. You've seen, you know, his game. Is he a running back worth taking in, say, the top 50 picks, or would he be someone you would wait on?
Me personally, I would not take him in the top 50 picks. I'll say that I am generally averse to taking running backs in the first round period. And I would be particularly hesitant to take Etienne in the top 50 must-us the first round because of how concerning his pass protection is. He's really small, first of all. I think they have him listed at 200 pounds, but I'm not sure that I believe that. And you watch him in pass protection, and it really shows. There's a reluctance there. There's an issue with technique. There's an issue with just having the requisite strength to pass protect. And so I don't know how you consistently fit him on all three downs. On top of that, you know, this is similar to the concerns about size and pass protection. I don't know how you run a guy like that 20 plus times a game. So to me, you're ultimately talking about a guy who you're not sure you can trust to protect your quarterback, which is obviously the most important position on the field. and you're not sure that he can stand up to the rigors of the NFL and carry the ball 20 times a game. So you're talking about a player who probably has a fairly limited role at a position that is not that valuable. So I don't know how you could justify taking that in the top 50 picks. You know, maybe if you're a team that has a luxury pick, you could. He's obviously explosive. He's going to get chunk gains. I mean, that's not a problem. But, you know, we kind of saw a similar thing with Saquon Barkley, where Barkley was a human highlight reel at Penn State, but the pass protection concerns were there, and obviously he's suffered some injuries that have limited his ability to be effective. But the Giants certainly didn't get the bang for their buck on that pick. And I think Etienne is a much lesser prospect than Barkley. So I don't think the...
So with him...
Go ahead.
With the pass protection for him, it's more physical than mental. Like,
I think it's all around. Yeah, I think that he's not strong enough to do it. I think that he, technique-wise, might be a manifestation of a reluctance to do it. But when you see him pick up his blitz assignments, he's not squaring guys up. He's generally trying to, you know, put a shoulder into them, cut them. I don't think the physicality is there. I'm not even sure that there's
I kind of
a template
that
to work with. Yeah, it's like, you know, if you have a guy who maybe isn't that polished technique-wise or maybe isn't that strong, but he's willing to do it, you might be able to work with that, but I'm not sure that even that is there.
Yeah, it's just like, I feel like, I know for me at least, I kind of like him just because I'm just a sucker for the speed, guys. Like, if you're someone that can hit an 80-yard touchdown, I'm going to be in. But, like, I do kind of wonder about the pass protection stuff. And then, you know, like, you in the your write-up on him in the handbook, you guys mentioned, or not you guys, you mentioned kind of his frame and how that might be a problem for him moving forward. But just like when you see guys that can score that easily, I just feel like he's probably going to go a little bit higher than top 50. And then from then, it's just like, how do we keep him on the fields on passing downs without him being like a complete sieve in pass protection? Because he can't run five-man protections all day because, you know, the blitz-happy teams will just crush you. So he's got to work on that. But if he can work on that, I don't really see why he couldn't grow into a three-down back. I guess it's just kind of like at his age, being a senior – coming back to Clemson kind of for no reason last year. Like, if he didn't get better at it then, it might just not happen for him.
So what kind of system do you think he would, like, thrive in if there is one? Like, what would you like to see him?
I think he's well-suited for zone, which is good because that's what most of the teams like to run nowadays. I didn't like him as much in the gap stuff that Clemson runs. I think he was kind of not necessarily impatient, because it's more about timing than it is waiting some arbitrary amount of time to do something. But I think he would overrun his pullers or cut into space that he shouldn't have cut into too early and things like that. I thought that he was much better at processing what was happening along the offensive line and zone schemes. And I think he's really good in that regard. In the mental aspect on zone. And I think that if you run him on zone stuff in the NFL, you're gonna get some big runs out of him for sure. But the power, the counter stuff that Clemson was running, he was not so good on.
So I've been watching the cornerbacks recently, and you always read about, like, this cornerback would be good in this type of system. This cornerback would be good in man heavy system. Someone would be good in a cover three system. How does total points measure what role a cornerback was playing in college? Because it is so varied across the different schools and conferences.
Okay, so I'm glad you asked this, and I'm going to eventually answer your question, but first I kind of want to set the framework for the data that goes into total points.
Okay.
When you're talking about charting coverages, you know, they're the obvious overarching coverage families that you have. You have, you know, middle field closed, middle field open, and then you have the basic coverages, cover one, cover two, cover three, cover four, so on and so forth. But as you guys know, there's a lot more that goes into it than that. And coverages can be extremely complicated, especially at the NFL level. So cover four for one team might be totally different than cover four for another team. So it can be difficult to equate those things one for one. And that is something that we're looking at improving from a data point side, is a big focus going into this off season, is adding data points and using those data points to improve our total point structure. But moving back to your original question, with the understanding that we're having to take a more simple view of coverages to power this, total points does have it does recognize coverage families at a very basic level. We aren't looking at individual assignments within the coverages necessarily, but we are looking at groupings of coverages and alignments. So we are setting some pre-snap expectation for the likelihood of a target based on your alignment. And we kind of go from there. Like, so for example, Jalen Ramsey is good at deterring targets, and that's reflected in his total points, particularly because doing so on the outside rather than a slot is valuable. So we do know that generally, given his alignment and the type of coverage that was played, that Jalen Ramsey is good at what he does, which is not a revelation or anything. But if you're talking about, you know, how good was this guy at being the curl the flat defender in cover four, we're not getting that granular, but we do have some general sense of coverage and alignment in this metric.
All right, that's good. So what? So who's SIS's top cornerback in this draft?
Top cornerback. Give me a second to look it up.
I'm gonna take a guess. I'm gonna go Patrick Surtain the second.
That would be my guess. That's my cornerback number one right now. I'm still watching, but J.C. Horn, to me, he's so lucky that apparently college arrest, and I hadn't noticed this in years before, but apparently they don't call defensive holding. Like, they just let him mug whoever, every receiver he was guarding against.
It's kind of fun. It's kind of funny to watch. Really. I was watching him a little bit earlier today. He's definitely a little handsy, but, you know, I keep getting stuck on, like, it's crazy that we're at the point Patrick Surtain, who – Asante Samuel Jr., J.C. Horn, Joe Horn's son. Like, where did the time go? how are we at the point where these guys are, like, all NFL prospects?
I still
old Charles.
I still remember when Patrick Surtain was, like, a young up and coming cornerback, and now his son's entering the league. We're all washed.
Yeah, Surtain and Sam Madison on Madden back in the day.
Offense
destroyers.
Okay, so yeah, Surtain and Horn are one and two for us.
See, look, I was just trashing Horn. He's number two for us.
That's bad promo. That's bad press.
Promo.
We got to be cleaner here.
it's bad promo for me probably because I've only watched one game, so I probably shouldn't be throwing takes out there. But is there does how does total points, and maybe you don't know the answer to this one, or maybe it just doesn't, how does it weigh like a penalties for a cornerback? How is he going to get punished for that?
So penalties, if I'm not mistaken, are accounted for separately because it's you know, if it's accepted, it's functionally a no play. So
right.
I can look at that.
There's so much data in here. I'm just looking at the page for Sertan. It has like yards per target, completion percentage. It's all this stuff that, you know, really helps like the lazy film watcher like me. I'm like, man, like, I could just know what I'm getting into before I'm watching it. This will save me so much time, but this is great.
Yeah, I think like I think that's my favorite aspect of the book every year is the cornerbacks. Like I've found cornerbacks that weren't necessarily being hyped before, and then you read about them in this, and I think it does a good job of not only giving you the stats, but it adds context to it. That's such a buzzword, but there is these full-on write up, and I'm wondering how much are do the analytics affect those grades that we see in the handbook, or is that just strictly film evaluation?
No, that's strictly film evaluation. We don't like to double count, and one of the things our director of football, Matt Mancherian, likes to say is that if you have these two separate data points, film and analytics, and they both tell you the same thing, that a player is good or bad, then you can probably be pretty confident that the player is good or bad, and that's valuable. When they disagree, that's just as valuable, because you might be seeing one thing on film and say, wow, this guy is really good, but his numbers are terrible. You should probably retrace your steps and think about what you're seeing. And if you're confident in that, great. But there's value in those things disagreeing. Because when they do disagree, you're more likely to make mistakes. And that goes for whether the film says he's good and the stats say he's bad, or the stats say he's good and the film says he's bad. You're using two data points to establish your confidence in a player. And that's the whole point of the book, is we want to show both sides of it and add as many data points as we can in conjunction with the film to paint a complete picture of the player. So we watch the guys, and you know, the scouts don't look at the statistics before watching. They're just watching the film and they write them up.
Yeah. How much of a difference, you mentioned this earlier, that, you know, the weirdness of the pandemic year caused some changes in how you do things, but how much more difficult do you feel it is this year to really feel confident about what you're getting? Because like you're saying, you have these different data points, but you have less film for a lot of guys. Some guys didn't put any new film on tape this year. And then the stats, you know, we all know a lot of these are small sample size, even in a full season when you're really thinking about it. And now some teams only played 4, 5, 6 games. How much more difficult was it this year for you guys and other people who are trying, you know, the NFL scouts who are trying to do this?
So that's a good question. I think for me personally, I wrote up a couple guys to the book, and some of them didn't play at all in 2020. I think that can make things difficult because you're essentially projecting further out, right? You're ultimately trying to find out what you think a guy will be in the NFL. So when you're looking at 2019 film and you're trying to figure out how good a guy is going to be as a pro in 2022 or 2023, even, you're having to make a bigger leap than if he had put film on in 2020. Another thing I think is difficult is you had a lot of weird stuff happening in terms of practices,
right,
and camps.
Yeah.
And so were the guys you're playing against at their best? You know, were you playing against a backup because somebody opted out? Were you playing against the backup because somebody was sick and on the COVID list? Were you playing against the guy who just wasn't as good as he should be because he didn't get to practice all summer, basically? That's another thing. But for actually scouting guys on film, I think it's not that bad in terms of sample, because scouting, I mean, honestly, maybe the biggest weak point of scouting is that you're going off of, you know, 3, 4, 5 games, with the advantage of statistics being the statistics see everything, maybe less in a less nuanced fashion, but they still see everything. So I wouldn't be concerned about sample size as much from a film standpoint as I would be the quality of the sample, if that makes sense.
One of those guys that didn't play last year was Gregory Rousseau from Miami, and you wrote that report. And I think he had 15 sacks 2 years ago, and he only played 1 year of college football. And while I was reading your report, I was like, does Bryce like this guy or does he not like this guy? It seemed like you were kind of high on him, but I don't know. Like, what are your thoughts on him, and how do you weigh, like, this is a specific example of what you were just talking about. How did you weigh in the fact that he only played one full season of college football?
So I'm a little offended that you weren't certain what I thought of him, because maybe that meant I did a bad job of trying to put my thoughts on paper. But yeah, Rousseau was
– you put both sides on paper. I thought it was a nuanced report.
Well, I think the problem with Rousseau is not just that he didn't play in 2020, but you're also talking about I think he was 19 when he played in 2019, and I believe he was a safety in high school. So you're talking about this young, wiry guy who probably hasn't filled out his frame very much. And when I watched him last summer, I was disappointed, because you see 15 sacks and you go to the film and you want to see some freak absolutely destroying people. And a lot of it was high effort sacks, you know, not necessarily quality wins. He won from some inside alignments on passing downs. So it was, on first watch, a little underwhelming. But then I think when I looked back and watched him more critically and considered that he's really just young and undeveloped, you see a guy who obviously has the size. He's got some quickness to him. He's got some bends, and he's got power. And you think about how he can win in the NFL, there's a place for guys in the NFL who can win with length and power and have enough quickness and bend to not be stiff as a board, that you can feel confident that he can be a quality starter in the NFL. Now, both sides you're talking about is he a Pro Bowler? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't confident enough to say that he would be a Pro Bowler force of nature, like you would maybe expect an All-American who put up 15 sacks and is built like a Madden creative player would be. But I do think that he has a pretty high floor, which led me to be comfortable enough to rank him as a quality starting NFL edge.
Yeah, I think I had the same experience reading about him, because you see the 15 sacks, and like you said, you're expecting like this athletic freak and just blowing people up. But also when you hear about a prospect with 15 sacks, you're either thinking, oh, you're going to love him because he is that explosive freak, or it was just fake production and that he actually stinks. And I guess your report kind of painted a picture that was in the middle of those. You didn't say he stinks, obviously, but you weren't. He doesn't look like a 15 sack a year type of player, but maybe he's an 8 or 9 sack type of player. But my question would be, where do you draft that type of guy, especially with him where the sample size is so small?
I think so. Now we're getting into valuation versus evaluation. I think that edge rushers are really important. Not that that's some crazy take, but I think for a guy who has that type of physical profile and who did have that statistical production at that young of an age, regardless of how legitimate you think it was, I think you kind of have to take a guy like that in the first round. Because, you know, 6'6", 260 pounds with quickness, power, and a little bit of bend doesn't grow on trees. And I don't think that that's something you can really wait on. Now, would I take him top 10? Probably not. Probably better options on the board at that point. But, you know, if you're middle to late half of the first round and you need a pass rusher, I wouldn't have any issue with the team taking him in that range.
Yeah, I think he's also kind of helped out by this being a relatively weak edge class. I mean, I'm a Georgia fan, and you know, when people were telling me that Georgia had a first round edge rusher, I was like, where? Like, I watch every single game. I feel like I would have known at this point. And you know, like if he's going to be the first edge off the board, which like very well may happen, just based on, you know, all the things that you were talking about. I mean, I don't think anyone should be surprised if he ends up going like top 20 or maybe even higher. I wouldn't take him there, but it just seems kind of like this. It's like a scarcity thing this year. We've seen in the past at premium positions when maybe there aren't super prospects on the board, like guys will get pushed up. So I think he could be the next beneficiary of that when it comes to the draft. Huh? I just hope it's not my team.
And it's not like he's a Charles Harris or anything. You know, right. It's not like he's a physically untalented player who had high production because he was more technically refined than his competition. I mean, you can see the physical ceiling with him.
So when the Lions are on the clock and they're choosing between Mac Jones and Gregory Rousseau, who would you rather them take?
Mac Jones. It means I don't have to watch Jared Goff.
But at the same time, you kind of do, because you drafted Mac Jones, you know?
I guess I said that, and then I knew somebody was going to say that. I knew either you or Steve. Fire back.
I had to take that.
By the way, did you guys see the video of the Lions GM? Now I'm blanking on his name.
Brad Holmes.
Brad Holmes.
Wow, fresh off Black History Month, too.
It's March.
That's why I said fresh off of it.
Oh, I thought you said it is. You guys only get 27 days.
Wait, I like how Steven's like really trying to use that. Like, why do I need to know about Black people in March? Like,
anyway, he was being asked about Jared Goff and whether like acquiring Jared Goff like takes them off the quarterback market. And he was – I've never seen a GM just like – deny something so bad. Like shaking his head for a good minute straight. And I just hope that Jared Goff didn't see that video, because now I'm like starting to feel bad for Jared Goff. Am I alone in that? Is anyone else feeling bad for Jared
Goff? Yeah, you are.
Well, I feel bad.
Jared Goff has made like $100 million, dude.
Yeah, that's honestly a fantastic point. But I guess I feel bad in the sense like, dude, how do you not see what's going on here? Like, why are you out in public saying that? It feels good to have a team that wants me. Like, you saw what the trade details were. Why are you saying that? Like, don't set yourself up for heartbreak, Jared. Like, stop that. That's the only thing I feel about. Feel for you,
Jared. Yeah, Jared Goff. You're criticizing. What a loser.
Oh, Anyway, back to the SIS handbook. You mentioned earlier how, like, you guys separate the film evaluation and the statistical evaluation. Are there any guys who, where there's a wide gap between those two, whether it's the stats look better than the film or the film looks better than the stats?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of talked about this with Lawrence and Wilson a little bit, but there's always going to be guys that are better on stats or better on film than they are on stats or vice versa. A couple guys that I think are a little overrated this year would be Texas' Samuel Cosmi. I've seen McShay and Kiper talk about him in the first round. Not that they're the end all be all, but I think they generally give a pretty good indication of what a guy's stock is. And for us, we had Cosmi 76th among tackles in terms of pass blocking total points per snap and 164th among tackles as a run blocker. So that's a little difficult to reconcile. Now, saying that, I haven't watched Cosme's film, but that in light of his stock probably merits some reconciling. And then another guy, I'll stay on the offensive side of the ball, is LSU's Terrace Marshall Jr. I've also seen him talked about as a first-round guy. And then you look at his total points, and among college receivers last year, he was 111th in total points per snap and 78th total. So that's another one where you look at it and you say, okay, this isn't quite adding up and merits further investigation probably. Guys that I would say are under the radar would be Virginia Tech running back Khalil Herbert. He ranked 10th in total points among running backs as a rusher, 14th on a per snap basis. And he's kind of interesting because he actually transferred from Kansas. I don't know if he was a grad transfer or not, but he didn't get a whole lot of run as a Jayhawk and then came to Virginia Tech and tore it up this past season. I think he had something like 1,200 yards, 8 touchdowns. And he fared really well for us. So that's one on the offensive side that I would think total points would say is underrated. And then on the defensive side of the ball, LSU linebacker Jabril Cox is somebody that probably should be talked about more. He was our number one linebacker in coverage by total points this past year. He was a grad transfer from North Dakota State, got a little under-recruited in high school because he blew out his knee towards the end of his junior year, so he didn't get a whole lot of run on the recruiting trail, but moves around really well and fares well in coverage. And considering the way the NFL has been trending for several years now, you need linebackers who can cover. I haven't seen him get a whole lot of buzz, so he's probably somebody that should be looked at a little harder at the very least.
I've got to question the Virginia Tech running back's decision making for committing to Kansas football in the first place.
We all do things we're not proud of.
There's some Les Miles jokes to be made here, but I'm gonna let them go. Bryce, thank you so much for stopping by, man. We really enjoyed the conversation. I mean, obviously, we could just ask you questions all day about a variety of players, but we are trying to encourage people to go buy the book. So you guys should do that. Bryce, really enjoyed it, and I'm sure we'll have you on again.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
All right. Good stuff. I feel like I have something of an understanding of total points now. I know that it makes me a smarter football fan for sure.
And Bryce accomplished his goal of not saying something that will get him fired. So kudos to Bryce.
He was the most careful guest we've ever had.
I would agree with that. Yep. It's
very, very clear. Most prepared, most careful in the history of the counter. Guys, anything we missed? Anything we didn't get to this week? What else happened in the NFL? It's just sort of that. Just waiting to
see. Yeah, I think next week we'll have a lot more to talk about next week. But this, you know, we're kind of at like the quiet before the storm part where the teams are starting to get their cap space in order. And, you know, some teams still have quite a bit of work to do. Like, I didn't even realize today when I was working on the article that the Eagles had like already made a handful of restructures this week. Like, they've already restructured Darius Slay, Jason Kelsey, Isaac Simwala, and Malik Jackson, and they're still, you know, $25 million over the cap. I'm like, how is this possible? So, you know,
we're gonna
see a lot of moves from teams like them, the Saints, the Rams, Falcons, Chiefs over the next week, as teams have to get under the cap by next Friday, which is kind of crazy that the league year is already starting.
Right. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I'm a little worried that we won't have that much to talk about next week on Wednesday, just because it is so, it's such a weird situation with the cap lowering the way it has and teams already being too close to the ceiling. And, you know, I think that there's going to be a waiting game for more players than usual. So we'll just have to.
We didn't talk about Dak.
I talked about it a little in the beginning. So yeah, we're happy.
But I think that's a good thing that we're not talking about Dak and overanalyzing this contract. Like, save your takes. Whatever your take is, it's unnecessary. He's a good quarterback. He got paid like a good quarterback.
Yeah,
the Cowboys are going to be fine.
He's a great quarterback.
Yeah. I mean, he's a great quarterback.
Right.
Like, and he got paid like one. So
we've been talking about this for a long time. It's really just amazing. I guess Jerry Jones said something like, if I've ever been taken advantage of financially, I'm glad it was by this guy or something. Which Jerry Jones just continues to be.
Jake, why are you saying that, dude?
Just a walking cringe.
Yeah. And especially he knows the insane money that's about to come with this next TV contract. Like,
Jerry Jones did not get taken advantage of, but
you're right. Like,
come on.
Jerry Jones is probably a person that is very familiar with the concept of taking advantage of people.
Yeah, I mean, right. No question. All right. On that slander, let's close off the episode. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you next time. Take care.
The Counter, an NFL podcast from USA Today Sports.